offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, coming to you live from our studios at Prashanti Nilayam, this is Prem, and with me is Arvind, and we are here to continue our satsang on the book Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba. As we are going through it, a couple of weeks back, we found that even though this book was a compilation of conversations that were had many, many decades ago, there is so much for us to learn even today, and sometimes it is contextual in a manner that it is so surprising and so fascinating. Today we're going to continue with what Swami started off last time. Swami started speaking about a specific meditation technique that Swami has spoken extensively about. In fact, if we were to go back to Swami's discourses, if we were to look for any discourse on meditation, I think one of the discourses or one of the themes that Swami has spoken many times over and over again is the Jyoti meditation or the meditation on the lamp. And I think we started off that a little bit. We said we will continue in detail because Swami gives a very detailed explanation of how this meditation has to be practiced. And there is an assurance that Swami gives at the end of it, but we'll come to it when we come to that section. It's very beautiful. I think we cannot be grateful enough to Swami for having made things so very simple, so very accessible to us. If we really were to put our head down and have that much surrender, I think there's nothing to be worried about, nothing really to look out for more than what Swami has told us. So with those few words, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. And before we go into that portion where Swami clearly explains how, why, and the nuances behind Jyoti meditation, let's once again offer our loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet. Sai Ram, Arvind.
Sai Ram, Prem, and Sai Ram to all our listeners. Last week we just began on the Jyoti meditation and we stopped because Swami explains in quite some detail, and there are some very interesting insights and practical tips which will be very, very helpful. So just to sum up, what we discussed last week was Hislop saying to Swami that, Swami, in meditation some of the Westerners are taking light alone, not the quite definite form of the Jyoti or the lamp flame, but just a formless light, and they are concentrating on that and projecting that. Is it correct to make formless light as the object of concentration? And Swami gives a very, very practical reply, saying that it is not practical to attempt to concentrate on that which has no form. To concentrate on the Jyoti is an illustration. The object of concentration can be sound form, can be sound or form, the Jyoti. It needs to be something concrete. It's not easy to fix the mind on the abstract. So that is where we had stopped last week, making it very clear that the flame is taken because it has a form. If you take general light, even then it becomes formless. So Swami says that the mind needs something concrete to focus on. And that's very easily understandable. In fact, I think after Swami left the physical, the number of miracles that are happening or the way Swami shows his presence in our lives, it continues. And if we examine our own lives or we ask anybody else also, we will get so many examples. We get examples at the rate of something like 4 or 5 times a month at least where Swami's unseen hand is seen. So the rate of such things happening continues to be the same as it was when Swami was in the physical. And yet we feel now that something is missing. And I think that comes because of our obsession to hold on to something concrete. We need something concrete as long as we are under the control of the mind. Swami says, master the mind, be a mastermind. But till we can reach that stage of mastering the mind and becoming the mind's master, at best we are friends with the mind, or in most cases we are subservient to the mind. So in both these stages, because we are at the level of the mind or below the level of the mind, we need something to hold on to. And that is the reason, though we experience so many wonderful leelas and mahimas of Bhagwan in our day-to-day life, we still feel that we are missing, Swami, you know, we are missing. Because that form is missing. That concrete concretization of that divine pure love. And that's possibly the reason why we, you know, hold on to videos or photos or even in some deviant cases, go try to, you know, find somebody else who will replace Swami. You know, we want some form, somebody who says, Swami is speaking through me, Swami is speaking through him. Then we get attracted, feeling that, oh, this is a concretization of that divine love. So since we are constantly seeking that concretization, Swami says, use a form of the light. Use light, but use it in a form, like the flame has a particular form. And then going ahead, Hislop asks, is there a particular pathway in which the flame or the jyoti should be moved in the body? And Swami gives all that detail. But one thing is very clear, that when we try to do meditation in the beginning, when we are at the level below the mind, it's always better to have a form, be it the form of the Lord, or even a form of light, which is the flame of a lamp.
Right. In fact, this discussion, as you rightly said, the next question is about the pathway the lamp takes. And I think maybe for the uninitiated, because from what Hislop is asking, there is a fair idea of what Swami speaks of as jyoti meditation. And so the question seems to be a bit abrupt for those who may not know about it. So the whole idea is you meditate on flame, and then you imagine that it is lit in the heart, and then you take it to different parts of the body, the different limbs, the different senses. And that is what is the basis of the question that Hislop is asking. Is there a specific pathway where you move the flame, you know, from the heart to the different places? The other reason why specifically a lamp and not probably an incandescent light or a flashlight or something, I think Swami explains that further. This basic idea of, you know, why is it important to think of something which is a form? The whole idea is, Swami had explained it a little bit in the previous portion also, and is going to speak about it later also. The whole idea is we are stuck in the physical, and we are trying to find a technique by which we are able to withdraw into the non-physical, or if I could put it that way. Right? And Swami would say this, the sense organs are the windows which connect the inner plane to the external plane. Mm. Right? And the sense objects usually need something to grasp onto. You know, be it the fragrance that the nose can grasp onto, the forms that the eye grasps onto, or for that matter, anything, any, you know, the weather, the sense of the various sense inputs that you get into, which can take you to a recollection or a mental state. So Swami says we are in the physical world, so it is better to have something that you can, that your mind can grasp on through the, you know, the mind, through the eyes, which is a form. At the end of the day, it's a form. And Swami would also say that the form also has associated qualities. So you pick a form that when you think about, you also think about the qualities. And that's why they would say that meditate on Rama and Krishna. And I think even last week we spoke about, yes, meditating on the thumb is a very effective, you know, technique, because it will help you in concentration. But when you meditate on a form which has a quality, you meditate on, you know, Jesus or any saint for that matter, you automatically associate some noble qualities with that form. So your mind is also thinking about those qualities. And Swami would say that's why picking forms of people like this is very, very important, or even thinking about Swami or thinking about Mother Goddess or anything, any of those thoughts help. But then Swami later very beautifully explains why a flame is, I don't know whether we'll have time to come to that, why a flame and not anything else. But I think for now we'll go into this specific pathway that Hislop is asking. Is there a specific technique?
And just adding to what you said, I remember reading a Sanskrit shloka. I don't remember the shloka now.
Mm-hmm.
I think Swami would also not quote that shloka or maybe say the same in Telugu. But the thing is, it says, it gives examples of different animals, right, saying how one sense going awry can lead you to death or something like that, destruction. Mm-hmm. I remember one being the honeybee, its sense of taste, it drives it into such a kind of pleasurable joy that as it sits on the lotus flower, the shloka goes that it is sucking the nectar, it is so lost drinking in that pleasure, that when the sun sets, the lotus closes and traps the bee inside, and in the evening an elephant comes and stamps the lotus and the bee is dead. Mm. And it says that
very beautifully Swami uses the same analogy. Just I think a couple of days back I came across Swami using the analogy for both a positive and a negative idea. Now, the negative idea, Swami says, the, you know, the black bumblebee, it can bore through wood. That's how powerful it is. But when it is lost in enjoying the nectar of a flower, even when the flower closes at sunset, it remains inside and it perishes. You know, it is not able to release itself from the, you know, grasp of...
From the tender, intoxication.
Yeah, tender petals are enough to capture it.
Hmm.
Right? Swami says this in the sense that we are lost in the senses. The same analogy Swami was saying, just like how, you know, the bee which is so strong and, you know, it is so lost in the world. When the mind gets intoxicated with the lotus feet of the Lord, then, you know, you completely get removed from the world. Even though your mind is so very, wild and uncontrollable, the mind becomes so soft that the lotus feet of the Lord is enough to capture it.
Wow.
What a beautiful way of explaining both.
I think that shows why Swami says, mana eva manushyanam karanam bandha mokshayo.
Right.
In one case, it is trapping the bumblebee. In another case, it is showing how it can liberate. It all depends on where we choose to focus the mind on.
Right.
And I think that's why we had also discussed this in other satsangs when, for example, when you enter a temple, the sounds that your ears hear, the sights that your eyes see, the smell that comes to your nose,
right,
and, you know, you warm your palm on the flame and the things that you feel. And finally...
The way people dress, for that matter.
Exactly.
The
everything.
Right.
All the inputs that all the five senses can get. And finally, yes, the taste. They give lovely prasadam and teertham in the end, you know. In fact, some of the famous pilgrimage temples in India are known by the prasadam that they dole out. So, it is ensured that all of that is so wonderful and beautiful because through all our senses, we should get in only noble and good thoughts and ideas. So, I think... though we often mistake this to be, we think that going to a temple is a spiritual activity. More often than not, it's a preparation for something that is coming later. In the same way, focusing on a flame or focusing on the form of the Lord, that by itself doesn't become a spiritual activity. Those are all the preparations that we need. That's why I think later on Swami also explains, but that's all the... It all comes in concentration. We have to move to contemplation and then meditation.
Right. In fact, there's another very similar to what we're talking about. Swami says in a discourse, you know, for us to be able to associate with Swami, there needs to be a stronger input. You know, you either see a picture of Swami, you know, you're in the middle of a meeting or you're going for something important and you see a flash of a picture of Swami and you feel that, yeah, Swami is with me. Right, or suddenly somebody comes and greets you, Sai Ram, or you get a message on your phone, which is, these are all reminders that Swami is there. So Swami would compare that with the Gopikas. The Gopikas were already so lost in Krishna that almost anything and everything would trigger a memory about Krishna.
Hmm.
Swami would say they would see the blue sky and they'll remember Krishna. They'll hear the call of a peacock and they'll remember Krishna. They'll hear the flowing of the river and they'll remember Krishna, the time they spent. So Swami would say, it's the same thing here. In the lower state, probably you need stronger inputs and stronger visual and sensual indicators for you to think of the Lord. When you go to a state where you're more and more lost in the thoughts of the Lord, almost anything can take you to that state of being connected with the Lord.
In fact, Swami would give the example of a Gopika by name Suguna, who needed the opposite kind of training. You know, here we are trying to focus and how can I see Swami in my work? How can I see Swami in this person? How can I see Swami in this situation? For Suguna, it was like you have to train her mind to see an object. Swami said that when they would go to light their lamp, she saw Krishna in the flame and she went and embraced the flame and her sari caught fire. I mean, it was almost like she had to be trained to see that, no, this is a fire, this is sari, this will catch, it is destructive in the worldly sense. So that is the kind of intoxication that the Gopikas had. And it's indeed phenomenal because from a worldly point of view, it looked like Suguna is suffering, she is getting burnt. But as far as Suguna was concerned, Swami said that she felt nothing because she saw Krishna everywhere, whether it's her sari, whether it's the sky, as you said, whether it's the fire, whether it's the water. So she just saw Krishna everywhere. And I'm sure in that state, you have no pain, you have no suffering, you have nothing because it's only Krishna consciousness or the divine consciousness that pervades.
Right. So going forward in this conversation, as we said, it's about Jyoti meditation. And the first question was about, do you need a a flame really to meditate upon, or can you think about a formless light? The next question that Hislop asks is there a particular pathway along which the flame, the jyoti, should be moved in the body? And Swami replies, the light is first moved into the heart, which is conceived as a lotus, the petals of which will open. The jyoti is then moved to other body parts. There is no particular sequence, but important is the final body station, which is the head. There the light becomes a crown enshrining and covering the head. The light is then moved outside from the particular to the universal. Move the light into relatives, friends, enemies, and all its forms are seen to have the same light as their center, as has been found to be within oneself. The idea of moving the light into the universal face, the idea of universality, is that the same divine light is present in everyone and everywhere. To impress this universality on the mind, we do the spreading of the light outside one's own body. One should understand that what comes about in meditation as one moves deeply into it is not the thinking of the light, but the forgetting of the body, and thereby the direct experience that the body is not oneself.
So, Swami here says that you start with seeing the light in your heart, which is like a lotus whose petals unfold, and then move the light. I remember in Balvikas, we would be having a guided meditation,
right,
where the Balvikas guru would tell us that now move the light to your right arm. Your right arm gets illuminated. It has become bright. And now move it to your left arm, your chest, your stomach, your thighs, your legs. And finally, they would bring it to the Bhrumadhya Sthana, or the spot between the eyebrows. That's where we apply vibhuti. That's supposed to be a center that is charged. So, and then Swami says, you know, move it outside to your family, your friends, and then your enemies. And then Swami says the trees, the animals, the birds, and the entire world and all its forms. When Swami would say about expansion love, this is what it is. It is expansion as well as love, because love comes from the fact that you see the same light in everyone. And expansion is, of course, is expanding because it starts from you. They say charity begins at home. Meditation also begins at home. Spirituality begins at home. It all begins from the individual. You have to start with yourself, and then we expand it to everyone. And see, it's also put in such a beautiful logical order, because when we think of it, the person whom we love the most in the universe is ourselves. So it's easiest to love myself. So easiest to fill myself with light. The next easiest possibly is to love my immediate family. You know, my wife, my children, my parents, my siblings. And so Swami says, spread it to that. And then the next easiest to love your friends, your acquaintances. Then it gets tougher, you know, enemies. So logically also it's beautiful. It is, as Swami says very clearly, to impress the universality on the mind. The objective of this whole thing is to tell the mind repeatedly and impress on it that, you know, all are one. Because ultimately that is the state we have to reach, whether it's bhakti marga, karma marga or jnana marga, the state of Advaita. So in this path of jyoti meditation, Swami says, the goal is to impress on the mind the universality, and therefore the light, therefore the expansion, and therefore the logical progression also, so that it becomes easy for us to do.
Right. I think in one paragraph or one portion, Swami so beautifully says the physical practice of what you're supposed to do, as well as immediately he says that, you know, don't get so lost in this. Because the whole idea is like, oh my God, today from the right hand I directly went to the leg. I forgot the left hand. That's not the whole idea. The idea is to reiterate yourself that you're not the body, and to understand that the same illumination which is within is in each one around. So these are the basic ideas. So probably when you wake up, or not wake up, when you get up from a jyoti meditation, if this is not the emotion with which you get up, I think you have not done the jyoti meditation properly. You might have missed a limb or two or a finger here and there. That doesn't matter. But if you don't wake up with this idea beaming or flowing out of your heart, I think then you've got it wrong.
So I mean, very clear. As you're sitting, if the neighbor because, you know, I'm saying this because my window is right next to the neighbor's kitchen window.
Okay.
And as you're sitting there, the cooker comes on and you feel like, hey, I want to burn that person to ashes. Then I think...
Use the same flame.
I think it's better to be with the blue flame in the kitchen rather than this Jyoti meditation flame, because the idea is to get the universality and anger, hate, irritation, frustration. I think all these are emotions that come when the differentiation, the diversity gets highlighted over the unity. And Swami says the practice of Jyoti meditation is to highlight the unity over the diversity. So as long as that doesn't happen, there's no purpose in the Jyoti meditation.
Right. And also, as you know, as you were rightly alluding to the guided meditation that some of the Balvikas teachers do, it's actually very beautiful. Many of them have been taught this directly by Swami. And even there, in this portion, Swami doesn't explain about that. But when Swami has taught this, Swami would say, the whole idea is that divine illumination is there within each one of us. You might be the most horrible person anybody could live with, but that doesn't take away the fact that that divinity is within. But when you're consciously thinking that the flame is now moving to my hand, Swami would say that now that divinity is filling this limb, which means whatever I do with this hand has to be holy. And then you take it to your feet and you say, now it's filling my feet. Wherever these feet take me, those should be the holy places. Wherever the eyes, whatever the eyes see should be holy, whatever the words that I speak. So the whole idea of that also is this. That, yes, we have the divinity within, but the problem with us is it doesn't really express itself in words, thoughts and actions as we do. The whole idea is, can we make it more conscious? Can we make it real that this is the divinity within, and let's see how much it can be shown outwardly in the physical world.
And probably the idea behind, you know, finally settling it in the head. I don't know the spiritual reasons, but I think practically it's possibly because the eyes are the source of the greatest damage we can do to ourselves, and the tongue is the source of the greatest damage we can do to others. So both are there in the head, and therefore maybe the light is there to ensure that these are the critical care units that need to be taken care of. And then Swami says, this is the stage of contemplation when the body is totally forgotten. That is, one should understand that what comes about in meditation as one moves deeply into it is not the thinking of the light, but forgetting of the body, and thereby the direct experience that the body is not oneself. Now that experience, Swami says, is contemplation. This cannot be forced. It comes about by itself and is a stage that naturally follows correct concentration. So it is not forced. It comes about spontaneously and naturally. And it comes about only if there is correct concentration. Vivekananda said that in meditation, he was unable to find his body. Where was this body? He could not find it. You know, I was thinking that the closest we come to possibly this experience in our day-to-day life is when we are playing sports, or say we are learning to ride a bicycle. You know, when we are riding the bicycle, I still remember, though I learned it at the age of 5 or 6, how difficult it seemed. It looked miraculous that a person is able to balance on two wheels. And now when I look at it, it feels miraculous that a person is able to ride a unicycle. Because a bicycle is, you know, bicycle, you wake me up in the middle of the night and just give me a bicycle, I can ride it. And this, it's effortless. I don't even think about it. But there was a point in time when I had to keep focusing. Oh, it's falling to the left, so turn it to the right. So bend towards the right, turn the handle. You know, it was all theory. If you're falling to the left, turn the handle to the left, but you move towards the right. But it would get reversed, you know. When you're falling to the left, you turn the handle to the right, and it falls even faster. And you say, oh, no, I have to move to the right, turn the handle to the left. Now, all of that happens automatically without even a single thought emanating. I don't even think that I have to go to the right or left. And I think that's a beautiful practical experience that we have had. Most of us have had. Even in games and sports, you know, cricket is one sport that we, in India, we love so much. When you go to learn batting from a coach, the number of points to keep in mind technically, tremendously high, from your stance to your grip, to where you keep the bat, to what kind of stroke, if you want to hit it to one side, what should be a body positioning. I think it's a complex combination of at least 15-20 factors which you have to remember one after another or at the same time. But once you have learnt it, when you're playing a match, you know, in a fraction of a second, we have seen some master batsmen face balls, deliveries that come to them at a speed greater than 150 kilometers per hour. And they are in perfect position and perfect stance and play it to get four runs, to hit it to the boundary, across the boundary.
Right.
And you, in fact, I have seen interviews where such players have been asked, you know, what do you think? How do you decide what shot to play? And without fail, every one of those great players, what they have answered is, we are not actually thinking. You just know that that has to be done. It's so spontaneous. So I think when years of practice precede, then you reach the moment of spontaneity where you can just do it without actually putting an effort to do that. It's not that, oh, this ball is 150 kilometers per hour. No, this has come. This is the position. Nothing with it. You can't think all that within that fraction of a second. You just know what has to be done. You see the ball and you play it. I think that is how it is. And that comes with a lot of practice. For us to expect that last 20 days, ever since the lockdown began, I'm doing it and I'm still not able to meditate, I think it's foolishness. Because people, even in sport, practice for 10-20 years before reaching that level of mastery.
I think the other problem is, you know, even in sport, I think when we were students, we always would find this, that there were some people who are naturally sportsmen. You know, they would call it the sports science. They'd probably pick up any game that you give it to them. And it would come much more naturally to them. There will be some of us who will have to really practice it. Probably a few months or a few years had to go into it. Maybe the same thing applies even to spirituality. That you find that some people find it very easy to get into a meditative state or even sit still for half an hour, 45 minutes, which is difficult for all of us. But I think the same thing that Swami would say about, you know, the progress being carried over from lifetime to lifetime is true for almost many of these talents. You find even that with young children who are able to, you know, catch the key and sing so easily, which we might have to struggle and learn for many, many years. But Swami would say that, you know, when you know that this is important, when you say that I want to meditate, I want to have control over my mind, when you have that Shraddha, then automatically you will put in that effort. You know, we are ready to put in effort for anything and everything, you know, whatever we may remember over lifetimes. Definitely balancing a cycle is something we have not remembered.
Correct.
We have struggled and everyone has struggled, and you know, I still recall you would have dreams in your sleep that you have mastered the cycle.
To wake up. You're fantasizing it.
Right. And you wake up with a disappointment that you actually have not and you have to learn. So similarly, when you know that I want to do this, you know, I want to achieve this, you're ready to put in that effort. So Swami would say that you should give importance. Yes, I want to achieve this progress in spirituality. Then automatically you'll be ready to put in those extra hours. You'll be ready to put in those efforts for months and years together and not lose hope. So I think that is an important thing.
And when you said, you know, that we see a child picks up. Yes, some people have that. You know, some lives seem to be better equipped to pick up certain things than the other. But another thing that you notice among all these greats, be it in sports, be it in music, be it in anything, any field, is that most of them, a majority of them, have started early. When Swami says start early, drive slowly, reach safely, it is so true for any field, including spirituality. And, you know, having a little child at home on whom you can experiment this, it is definitely visible. Things that we emphasize on and we give importance to and we show interest in, the child also seems to have a faster ability to pick up exactly those things. You know, I think that is where even studies have shown that the environment in which a child is brought up is important. But again, you know, the environment in which a child is brought up is so important, because I think this kind of impact will not happen on possibly a 25-year-old or a 40-year-old. You know, in the same environment, get a 25-year-old, he may say after 20 days, this is crazy, these people do nonsensical stuff, I'm leaving the home. But if it's a 3-year-old child in that same, after 25 days, maybe the child begins to love that entire, you know, whatever environment is being built at that home. So, start early, drive slowly, reach safely is so important, even in spirituality. Because, you know, just yesterday I was seeing an interview with one... She's become the latest singing sensation, Hindustani. Her name is Kaushiki Chakravarti. And she's saying that she started learning Hindustani music at the age of 2.5. She's now 30. She's a sensation. She's considered as one of the top Hindustani artists in India. The one who can sing the notes at the fastest pace. Just have to do a normal web search for her videos. It's phenomenal. But there she says that the most important were her young years. And she gives a reason also. She says, you know, because as a child, my father, who was my guru, came and told me that, you know, you do this 500 times. And I would do it 500 times. She didn't go to school, though now she is a master in philosophy. She didn't go to school, but she would spend 10 hours as a 10-year-old practicing music because she had to finish 500 times. And she says that once you reach teenage years and reach near your 20s, if somebody comes and tells you, do this 500, your guru tells you, do it 500 times, you say, why 500? 200 is enough, right? What's the difference? So she says that kind of innocent obedience is there in a young age. And therefore, that is best. And she says, this kind of questioning and thinking is good once you have mastered the basic techniques because it helps you get creative. You know, I was just thinking the same thing you can extrapolate to a spiritual life as well. As youngsters, we just listen to what Swami says. And we have seen that also. The way Swami handles a primary school child to a way Swami handles a university student in age. To some, it is said, no, this is what you have to do. In others, Swami says, this is what I feel, this is what I like. It is different. So, definitely, even in the spiritual field, it is important for us to start young. If we feel it's too late for us, we have gotten old, let us ensure that whoever comes under our influence, we are able to enthuse them to start early, drive slowly, and reach safely. On that note, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break. Because after that, Swami again continues speaking about the Jyoti meditation and again, very, very interesting insights come. All that after this little break.
Sai जीवन ज्योति तुम हो साई
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 प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ की ज्योत जलाओ
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ साई प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ साई प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ की ज्योत जलाओ
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ सारी प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ साई प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ साई प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
जीवन के इन अंधियारों में साई दीप जलाओ
Welcome back, dear listeners. We will continue with the Jyoti meditation technique that Swami is so beautifully revealing to Hislop and through him to all of us. Swami says, seeing the light and moving the light here and there is to give work to the mind, to keep the mind occupied in the right direction so that the mind will not be thinking of this and that and thus interfering with the process of becoming more and more quiet. Spreading the light into its universal phase, sending the light into every other body, and when one is so concentrated in it that he is no longer conscious of the body, is the stage of contemplation. As contemplation deepens, the stage of meditation comes about on its own volition. It cannot be forced. If the meditator remains conscious of himself that he is engaged in meditation, then he is not meditating, but is still in the preliminary stage at the beginning of concentration. So there are three stages: concentration, contemplation, and meditation. When contemplation deepens, it moves naturally into meditation. Meditation is entirely above the senses. In the state of meditation, the meditator, the object of his meditation, and the process of meditation have fallen away, and there is only one, and that one is God. All that may change has fallen away, and tat tvam asi, thou art that, is the state that exists. As one gradually returns to his customary and habitual state of consciousness, the jyoti is again placed in the heart and kept lighted there throughout the day.
Very beautifully, I think the standout sentence, at least for me, was where Swami is clearly saying that moving the light around is only to give work to the mind. Now, that's why Swami is making it so practical and simple. You know, it's not any mumbo jumbo. Swami is making it very simple. The mind needs to be kept active, and it's like a guided meditation that you're doing with yourself. You know, one thing is when somebody telling from outside, and you're listening to it, or you're listening to an app, and you're doing a meditation. But meditation itself is that only. You're just trying to guide your mind into thinking about something, and eventually you're taking it to a state of concentration, and then to a state of contemplation.
In a sense, it's almost like karma yoga, right? Because that's what Swami says also. In fact, Swami says this interchangeably. He says, if you do your work sincerely, your duty with all attention, that is only meditation, Swami says.
In fact, you know, the what Swami said in the end, where Swami was saying that the meditator merges in the meditation, Swami would say, I think in Dhyanamani, Swami clearly states that the dhyana, the dhyaya, and the dhyatha.
The person who does,
right, the meditator.
Does.
Right. So basically all three becomes one. So if you really look at it, that's what happens in devotion too. No, Swami, in Bhagavata Vaini, Swami says that the bhakta, the bhakti, and the bhagavata. I'm sorry, the bhakta, the bhakti, and the one who is the...
Bhagavan.
Right, Bhagavan. So these three merging into one is meditation. And similarly, as you're saying, the same thing happens in Karma Yoga also. Only difference is probably meditation here Swami is speaking of as a technique that you can use, which is very useful, whether you're a devotee or you're a Karma Yogi or whatever it is. The technique of meditation is sometimes something very useful for anyone. As Swami would say, you know, you could, all of us could do with a little bit of concentration and a little bit of control over the mind. Whatever activity we are doing, be it music, be it, you know, driving a car or writing a thesis or whatever it is, a little bit of mind control is helpful for anyone. So that's why technique of meditation is universally useful for everyone. And in teaching a technique of meditation, Swami is teaching us what would be the most noble and best way to sublimate the mind also.
And finally, you know, when Swami says that the sole goal of this whole thing is Tattvamasi. Thou art that. You have to reach that state of Advaita. I am reminded of an interesting episode that was narrated by one of our seniors, Brother T.N. Giridhar.
Mm-hmm.
He was saying that he observed a very interesting interaction between Swami and a student in Thrai Brindavan. The student was carrying a huge accountancy textbook. You know, accountancy textbooks are 400, 500 pages big and so fat they were. And he was keeping it on his lap as Swami came walking. He looked at that book and Swami said, oh my God, such a big book. What is that for? And the boy said, Swami, this is what we have to study. You know, it was almost like him telling Swami that you have no idea the difficulties we go through. This is what we have to study. This is the exam that we have. And Swami asked, so how many, so you will get how many questions from this book? And the boy said, Swami, about 12 questions. Swami said, 12? Not 12, Swami, 12 are there, but any 10 I can answer. So 2 will be left in choice. So 10 questions. Swami said, such a big book, only 10 questions. Is this what your examination is about? And this boy had nothing to say. Then Swami said, you know my exam how it is? And Swami said, in my exam, there'll be only one question. And Swami said, I will tell you what is the question also. And Swami said, I will also tell you what is the answer. Swami said, the question is, who are you? And the answer is, Tattvamasi. But I will not tell you when I will ask the question. So, you know, it is that kind of preparedness. And so Swami said, that's all it is. The entire thing about life, Swami's examination, God's test, is about this one question, who are you? And the answer is, I am you. You are divine. That's all. But when I will ask, I don't know. You be ready every time. So, this was interesting because Brother Giridhar was narrating how Swami gave him multiple opportunities and never could he muster courage, he said, to even say that, he says that I couldn't even tell Swami, when Swami asked, who are you, to tell that Swami, I am a part of you, Swami, I am your friend, nothing, I couldn't tell that at all, forget saying I and you are one. Despite knowing it theoretically that this is the answer Swami is expecting, it becomes so difficult to give. Obviously, because this is not an answer that we practice to give verbally, but an answer that we have to practice in our day-to-day, minute-by-minute life. And only when we do that, we reach that state. So whether it is meditation, whether it is devotion, whether it is karma yoga, as we said, all those are possibly different perspectives, different views, but all of them head towards the same goal, which is getting merger or oneness with Swami.
No, I was watching this movie once. I think I don't recall the name of the movie. It's about somebody just surviving in the wild. He's being hunted by a pack of wolves and he's trying to protect his life. And I think in the process, he tries to kill some of the wolves and all that. Very well-made movie, for the sense that, you know, for a brief time, you feel that you're the character there. And the thought that I got was, you know, in a situation like that, how spiritual we really will be. Right? You're really trying to keep your bone and skin together. When Swami is saying that this is the question and this is the answer and I'll ask you at a time when you're not prepared for it. If Swami were to ask you at such a time, you know, will we say that Swami, I and you are one? It's really, it's not possible. I think at least right now, if you ask me, it's not. Because that's what Swami says. It's not about knowing the answer, knowing the question. It's about being that answer, and that's going to take a lifetime. And that's so true, you know, I think Brother Giridhar and so many others would narrate this. We all know that when Swami asks, where do you come from? You know the answer. The right answer to give is, Swami, we come from you. Because you've heard it from Swami's discourses. We've heard Swami appreciating the primary school children when they give the answer. But you know that any number of times you could be prepared for it, but Swami will ask you at a time when you cannot give the right answer. Right? Mm-hmm. That's because that answer is it's not part of you. And I think even today they were playing this beautiful discourse that Swami gave during Christmas. So Swami was saying that, you know, Jesus is what he was because while being put through some of the things that you and I cannot imagine, at that time he stuck to those beliefs. Right? Even at that time he was thinking compassion, forgiveness while on the cross. And that is what makes, you know, Jesus who he is. So the giving the answer is not the right thing. I mean, it's not the difficult thing. And meditation is a process by which, you know, as Swami says, you are taking out time from your busy life where you're practicing this. Till a point when you come when you don't have to sit and meditate. You're always in that state. That's why Swami was saying in the previous portion that, you know, you're thinking this, you know, the same light is within me, the same light is everyone, I am not this body. And then you try to carry that emotion through your day as much as possible. Till a point where you don't need to practice this and carry it. You know, it becomes a natural state.
Going ahead, Hislop says, in meditation on the form of God, Swami says that transition into the states of contemplation and meditation occurs naturally without the volition of a person who is meditating. But how does this tie into the meditation on light, where the meditator is deliberately and with volition moving the jyoti here and there? And Swami says, the three stages, concentration which is below senses, meditation which is entirely above the senses, and contemplation which lies in between and is partially within the senses and partially above the senses, which is on the border of each. This is the experience in genuine meditation, whether the object taken is a form or light. There is no essential difference. If the devotee has a form of God to which he is particularly devoted, he may merge that form into the jyoti, and that form is most attractive to him and is the object of his concentration and is seen to be within the light wherever it is seen. Or the concentration may just be on the form of God, for God is universal in every form. Again, the object chosen is just a device to allow one to sink deeply into quietness and to allow the body, which is non-self, to fall away out of consciousness. Anything concrete such as light, form, sound may be chosen as the object of concentration. It is not possible just to move directly into the stage of meditation.
Right. Very beautiful, and I think
self-explanatory.
Yes, and the main thing is, as I think we had discussed last time, about meditating on a form that you love, meditating on a form or a person that you already have love or emotional attachment towards. We were saying how contemplation becomes so much more easier You know, you don't have to force yourself to concentrate on a form like that. You know, so many times it happens to us. You just need to see a video of Swami and you're lost, right? You're lost to the surroundings around. So that's why Swami says contemplation is easier. But when you talk about jyoti meditation, it seems like something that you're deliberately doing, that, you know, you're carrying the flame all around. But Swami is saying that at one point it becomes a process which is being done very, very intuitively without any force or without any deliberation in that sense. And Swami is saying that that light is nothing but you're looking at, I mean, you're just imagining a form and there's nothing wrong in merging that form with the light, merging that light with the form that you meditate upon.
You know, all said and done, I just think that, again, going back to that example of as a child, we are implicitly obedient. I think sometimes it so happens that many times we want the Falashruti. We want to know what will happen, how it is best, and we want the easiest way possible. So many questions we keep asking without, you know, possibly having put in that much effort, because we feel that what if that effort is wrong, it will go futile. I think that is where the firm conviction that, you know, Swami is guiding me, and if I am taking a wrong step, Swami will stop me. If Swami has not stopped me, it must be needed for me, necessary for me. I think this conviction becomes so important, because even though there are people who have traveled this path, nobody is able to transfer that experience onto us. Each one is by oneself. And therefore, it has to start with faith and with a lot of effort. How many of our questions can get answered, nothing can substitute for experience. So I think, at least personally for me, reading this whole thing and going through this, just makes me feel that I must start putting effort. Then we shall see what happens. And after this, Swami goes on to a thing that is one step more fantastic than meditation for most of us lay people, because we look at it in awe. That is Kundalini. But before we go into Kundalini, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break and then continue on the other side of it. Welcome back, dear listeners. As we said before the break, the next theme that is brought in after meditation is Kundalini. And as I said, this is something that keeps us in more awe because we think that possibly we can attempt meditation, but Kundalini is something that only the stalwarts and the stars and the yogis go into. So Hislop says, in speaking of yogas, Swami says that bhakti yoga, devotion to God, is the only yoga worth the bother, that the others are useless. But the Westerners complain that Ramakrishna Paramahamsa describes how he saw the Kundalini factor rise and open each chakra. What is the correct reply to this doubt? And Swami says, Ramakrishna used the chakras as symbols for locations of greater sensitivity along the spinal column. There is a great deal of misunderstanding about this so-called Kundalini meditation. The chakra is a wheel. There are no wheels in the spinal column. The wheel is taken as a symbol because the circulation of the blood is circular. The discs of the spinal column are also circular. By placing the wheel at various points along the spinal column and giving these points particular names, one is able to fix his mind on those stipulated areas and move the mind from one to the other. So Swami is saying that it's, you know, the chakras, I think chakras form one of the most important terminology in Kundalini yoga, Kundalini meditation. Swami is saying chakra is just a concept to show circulation, a completion, a cycle. It's not like there's a wheel over there. But since the spinal column is also like multiple discs, you know, that's why they say spinal disc, slip disc, all these. There are like discs, it's cylindrical and made up of multiple discs. So Swami says you place this disc mentally at different spots, different positions. So it is also akin to a kind of, if I can say, Jyoti meditation, where you are in a sense imagining, but then the mind has such power that what it imagines, it's able to, what it visualizes, it's able to materialize. And I think that is being used, whether it is Jyoti meditation or Kundalini. So Swami says that's what it is. And I think later he even goes on to say that it is not as advisable to practice Kundalini as it is for Jyoti meditation.
Right. And, the standard thing when many people speak about Kundalini yoga and all that, as you rightly said, the very mention of it makes you feel like this is very esoteric and this is for a very limited audience in that sense. And even in Indian literature, I think that is the one which is very complex. You think of so many things. There's one very beautiful shloka in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna is speaking about Karma Yoga. After giving the entire thing, you know, the basics of Karma Yoga, I think all of us know. At the end of it, he concludes by saying that this is all is required. And the way he says is, this is all is required to reach the goal. Everything else is only fancy, right? It's not that everything else is bad or detrimental, but this is all is required. You know, you can do this all your life and you can be sure that you'll reach the goal. So I think in that sense, much of what Swami has said, everything that Swami tells us in his discourses, in his writings, is very simple. You know, when Swami says, be good, see good, do good, it's not good enough for us. Right? Because we feel it's too simple, Swami. It's like a poster that you read on a car bumper or something like that. But that one dictum which Swami gives is going to take, it'll take a lifetime to follow, and that is all it takes. But then when we look at all of these different kind of yogas, and especially in the world today where everything is marketed and everything is spoken of as, you know, something exotic that you can go after, I think what Swami is saying in this portion and this particular part we are reading is very, very important, especially for Swami's devotees. This is not to discourage people from taking to all of these yogas, but probably to say that, you know, if you really fancy it, you're welcome to try it out. But is it necessary? Is it mandatory for Swami's devotees? I think what Swami is saying is absolutely clear here.
You know, I often think if you take a game of soccer, all you need there is good tackling, good passing, and in passing what becomes very important, and I say this because I have seen a hockey movie, a soccer movie, multiple movies made on this theme, wherein you need to be selfless. Because, you know, you may do some hard work and you may give an easy pass to a person to score a goal. But for the progress, you need to be selfless. So, in soccer, all that is needed is good tackling, good passing and selfless passing. And you win it. But then there are so many stunts, acrobatics, you know, jugglery that can be done, which provides a lot of excitement to the spectators. But do we play for the gallery or do we play to win the game? All that is necessary to win the game is nothing but boring tackles, boring passes. That's all it is. I feel the same thing it is also in the spiritual field. To win the game, what we need to do are very, very simple things, but we need to do them consistently, repeatedly, possibly monotonously and boring. That is why possibly we also seek some of these highs, you know, think that, oh, this is something exotic, this is something nice. It's for the sake of excitement, possibly playing to our own mind's gallery here, because we think, oh, this is good, this looks fantastic, this is amazing, it'll be fantastic if I can possibly levitate or walk on water. We don't need to levitate or walk on water to achieve the ultimate goal in life, but it feels like a good indicator of our progress, and that's why we seek that possibly. And I feel that is what Swami is trying to say here also, because when Hislop says, but Swami, how about the idea that the snake of Kundalini awakens at the base of the spine and activates each chakra as it rises up? Swami says, that energy is prana, the life force. It is imagined as rising up the spine by the practice of pranayama. The practice of pranayama is dangerous unless all circumstances are exactly correct. It is not necessary, and Swami advises against it. The area between the 9th and 12th vertebrae is specially sensitive. An injury there can result in paralysis. Meditation, as described by Swami, is the royal road, the easy path. Why bother with other practices? For meditation to be effective, there must be a steady practice with no hurry and no worry. With steady practice, the person will become quiet and the state of meditation will naturally come about. To think otherwise is weakness.
I think it cannot get clearer than this. You know, here is Swami, he's saying that I'm giving you this technique. This is so simple. This is so lovable. This is so something that you can connect with even as you're doing it. But then we are reading something else or we are excited about something else. We've heard from someone and we're saying, Swami, can I practice this? The thing with Swami is just like how we go to Swami with different ideas for our own life. Somebody wants to be a doctor. Somebody wants to be an engineer. Probably Swami would encourage that and Swami would help us even in that. You know, Swami helps us become a better doctor or in what way we can sanctify our life if we have taken to the army or we've taken to a business. But the thing is, what is required is basically very, very simple, as Swami is saying here. You know, I'm giving you the simplest and the basic technique which is required. But then if you say that, you know, I want to try it out, probably Swami will guide us in that also. I think that's what Swami said earlier, and he says it again later also, where Swami is saying that when you call upon God, God will come and help you in success. So Swami does say that, but Swami is saying that, but if you ask me, this is all is required. And when we are talking about ourselves, when we're talking about devotees, the question we need to ask is, what does Swami want us to do and stick to that? And that's all it takes. And in fact, in one line, Swami is making it very, very clear that don't try all these stunts. It is not advisable, and Swami advises against it. So I think it cannot...
In fact, he says, when he says that meditation as described by Swami is the royal road, the easy path, Swami continues to say, success is assured. Call upon God, He will help you. He will respond and He Himself will be your guru. He will guide you. He will always be at your side. Think God, see God, hear God, eat God, drink God, love God. That is the easy path. The royal road to your goal of breaking ignorance and the realization of your true nature, which is one with God. So, Swami is saying that is the easy thing, but we always think, but how can it be so easy? This is such a great life step. It cannot be that easy. And it's almost like we need more jargon. We need more mantras. We need more severe and unique practices. We need some advice, like stand on one foot and do something. Swami says it's all about loving God. And as a secondary statement, which Swami has not made here, but it's very clear throughout the conversation, is you need to love God and therefore do any practice that helps you to love God more. That's all. Whether it's bhakti, karma or jnana, do this and call upon Him and He will help. So, Swami makes it very clear that this is the easiest and best path to God. Others are also paths, but why would you want to choose a path that is not easy?
Right, and it's so very clear and simple that Swami gives that, you know, when Swami says this is the royal path, it's an easy path. It's almost like when Swami was talking about the spot between two vertebrae and how it's a very sensitive point, 9th and the 12th vertebrae. Swami is hinting at, yes, there is truth in whatever is being said about different chakras. And, you know, Swami also speaks about pranayama and the kumbhaka, rechika, and Swami says how that has an influence in the body. Swami speaks about pranic centers in the body. But do you really need to know about all of that to follow this path? I think that's what is the question, and Swami is saying it's not necessary, right? When you do what has to be done, everything else is going to be taken care of. It's not necessary to overwhelm yourself with everything. It's just like how you, Swami would say that you have a path which is 2 kilometers long. You don't need a light which is going to show you the entire path. All you need is a lantern which shows you 2 steps. So what Swami is saying is that only. You just need this lantern. It's simple. You just need to take 2 steps at a time and you will eventually get there. Oh, there is a bridge. Oh, there's going to be a desert in between. Yes, you will come to it when you come to it, and you don't have to worry about it even before you take the first step.
The other analogy that Swami would often give is when a doctor gives you a prescription, all you need to do is just take it. You need not know what is the composition of the medicine, what is the biochemical reaction that will take place, how it will work. No, you need not. You have faith in the doctor and take the prescription, it will work. In the same way, I think we should just wholeheartedly take the prescription of the divine doctor. When Swami says loving God is all that matters, that's all it is. And, you know, when Swami says, see, whether it is meditation or kundalini, the ultimate state to reach is the same. It's almost like through kundalini you can reach the ultimate. Through meditation you reach the ultimate, yes. But why would you take a more riskier path to reach the same goal when you can do it as well with the other path? And Swami clearly also gives the indicators, you know, of progress on the path. Swami says that you will become quiet and the state of meditation will naturally come about. And I remember we had done a satsang, I think a 2-part satsang on what are the indicators that we are spiritually progressing. I remember we concluded with the thought that as long as we are obsessed about our spiritual progress, possibly we are not progressing that much. But in the course of the discussion, we also saw 3 things, I think. One is how frequently we get agitated, disturbed, angry, upset. Because when Swami is saying that a person will become quiet, so thing that moves us away from the quiet are all these agitations. So the frequency of the agitations, the intensity of the agitations, this is what we discussed. And also, how much time it takes for us to overcome this. You know, before if I get upset, I'm upset for 2 weeks. Now within 2 hours, if I'm able to get over it, it's a sign of progress. Before the intensity would be so much that possibly I get headache and get a slight fever. Now it's not so much, it's progress. Possibly before I would get 3 times upset in a day, now I get only upset once a day, that is progress. So these are, you know, the indicators that are very, very practical and day to day. So Swami says you need not measure your spiritual progress in terms of your levitating abilities or your water walking abilities or all these exotic things. These normal things, are you able to speak more lovingly? Are you able to be more patient, more tolerant? These are the ways we can measure our spiritual progress.
If you really look at it, you know, when you're in the outside, when you're in the world and when your parameters of success are different, that's why you'll be fascinated when you see somebody, oh, this person has such a car. This person has made so many trips abroad in this 1 year, or this person has visited so many places. Or you look at that person's social media photographs and say, oh, he's been to all of these places. I think we carry that same kind of comparison when we come into the spiritual realm too. And I still recall, you know, when we were students, typically it's like you've suddenly opened yourself to the spiritual world with all the spiritual progress and all of that. There would be all these kind of things. Somebody would come back from vacation and say, you know, I met this sadhu or saint or somebody. He can see where your kundalini is. I remember this, one of my classmates saying this. You know, if he looks at the person, he knows where the Kundalini has progressed. And then he looked at so-and-so and said that, oh, your Kundalini is midway because you're a Swami's devotee. And, you know, we are fascinated by that, oh, you know, this is progress. And somebody else had said that, you know, they can see auras of people.
Hmm.
And for us, some of these things also become validation of who Swami is. Oh, you're a Swami's devotee, so I can see your aura like this and all of that. But really speaking, it is the same kind of comparison that we bring into the spiritual field. In fact, there's this very beautiful conversation between Karunamba Ramamurthy and Swami, this devotee from Mysore who came in the 40s.
Mm.
So she asked this question, Swami, how do we know that we are progressing? And Swami's response was, why do you want to know? He said, I know how much you're progressing, but if I tell you, it'll only lead to ego. Swami said, that is why I'm not telling it to you. And Swami said, I also know how much each one has progressed. So Swami said, it's not necessary. If it is necessary, I will let you know. Because it will only add to ego, and unlike in the worldly sense, ego is an impediment in the spiritual path. So why would you want to know? So all of these things is a fascinating indicator of, you know, how much you're progressing. And it, you know, even when it comes to meditation, I've heard this, some people say that, you know, I can sit for meditation for 2 hours. It becomes like a talking point. It becomes like, you know, something that you wear like a badge on yourself. It is not necessary sometimes in the spiritual path. Just
it's like a meditathon, not a meditation, like a marathon.
Right. And as Swami is saying here, just put your head down, do what you're supposed to do, and you will progress. There's no doubt about it, because this is a technique taught by Swami himself, right? The goal, the destination itself is telling that this is all you need to do. Of course you will progress if you're doing it the right way. You don't have to worry about you're progressing or not.
You know, when you said that, I was just thinking, getting a little into chemistry and physics, we have this Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, wherein for these small subatomic particles, if you are able to determine the position accurately, you go wrong in determining its momentum. And if you're trying to determine its momentum accurately, you get it wrong in its position. Basically, because for you to observe any particle, you need light striking that and coming back to you. And when the particle happens to be so small, light itself is able to bring about a change. So the minute you shine light on it to see something, its position has changed. The very act of you trying to see something changes it. So I was thinking that's what is happening even in spirituality when we are trying to measure our progress. Say I have reached 80 out of 100. The moment Swami comes and tells you are 80 out of 100, the pride that comes in me brings me down to 70 automatically, I think. And Swami then says, hey, no, not 80, you're actually 70 only. And then you feel so bad and repentant and, oh God, no, I'm so... And that act of repentance and feeling sad again brings you up to 75. So I think in that sense, possibly this is the scientific part in me that is jumping up in excitement. But it's almost like you can never get it right, because the very act of revealing changes your spiritual progress. And that's possibly why Swami told so categorically to her that why you need to know. You just reach, and once you reach, we automatically know. It's amazing how we are so eager to talk to others or tell others or communicate about our progress. But when we see those that have really reached, they are not in any mood to communicate at all that they have reached. So I think all this happens when we have not yet reached. The moment we have reached, there's no big deal about it. There is no communication. There's no drum beating and saying that I have reached.
Right. So the summary of that entire portion is Swami saying that this is all you require. This is the royal road. A simple jyoti meditation. And even that jyoti meditation, I think Swami broke it down to remove all the misunderstandings about it and the kind of aura that we end up giving it to it. Swami is just simply saying it is just controlling the mind. You're just giving the mind something to do. You are concentrating on something. And you're trying to remind yourself you're not the body. You're trying to remind yourself that the same Atman which is in you is in everyone. So Swami is saying that that's all it is. And it's just a guided technique so that your mind is kept occupied. Swami says nothing more is required. And probably we'll just take the next conversation where Hislop is asking about another technique that Swami has spoken about, where Hislop says, Swami, the Westerners are extremely interested in everything that Swami says, and they think and talk about it. The fact that the breath is saying Soham 21,600 times a day has some of the people puzzled. because they say they do not experience breathing at that rate. And Swami replies, the 21,600 breaths per day is the typical experience. It is the average of one's life. At times of exertion or stress, the breathing will be very fast. At times of peace and quiet, it will be slow. Some people may have an average of more than 21,600 breaths per day. A practiced yogi may average not 15 breaths per minute, but as low as 6 or 7 per minute. The slower the breathing, the longer the lifespan. The short life donkey will breathe some 40 times per minute. The long life snake will breathe 3 or 4 times per minute. So this is about the soham, and actually speaking, 21,600 times is a fairly average number, because I just googled, you know, how many times do we breathe in a day. I think it's around 20,000 to 30,000 is what is the average. As Swami is saying, it is not like you sit down and you take count the number of breaths that you take in a minute and then extrapolate that. Swami is saying that in different times of the day, as we all see that, you know, different emotions we go through, or you're walking faster, or you're climbing staircases, and that time it's different. So the average is about 21,600 times, and Swami would say that many times that your own body is reminding you that you are divine. So that is the whole idea. It is not about, my body didn't remind me as many times as somebody else's.
No, you check that way, I check the other way, you know. I try to see how long does it take for me to breathe when I'm absolutely bored. Okay. Because I didn't want to be happy and excited, nor did I want to be depressed and sad. When I was just feeling like nothing, neutral, bored, nothing was going on much. At that time when I checked, I saw that I finish one breath cycle on an average in about 4 seconds, because in about 20 seconds I had finished taking breath and exhaling 5 times. So around 4 seconds. And you know, interestingly, that's what it exactly works out to. If you take a breath every 4 seconds, it works out to 15 breaths per minute. It works out to about 900 breaths per hour. 900 into 24, you come to 21,600 precisely. Mm-hmm. So I think that is the average. And it's my own understanding and extrapolation that if we are able to keep it at that, we will live a 100-year lifespan. The more agitated we get, or the more we breathe because of, say, obesity, diabetes, whatever, because of health conditions or mental health conditions or psychological health conditions, you breathe faster, possibly you die faster, and you breathe slower, possibly you live longer. You know, very interesting. Of course, I'm going on the tangential side on the number of breaths, because Swami clearly says here it's not about the number of breaths, but it's about the message that the breath gives you. But even going along the number of breaths, it's very interesting, because in the Bharatiya tradition, lifespan to a being is not given in number of years. It's given in the number of breaths. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the more you are relaxed and calm, the longer you live. So usually we say that human lifespan is an average 75 years. I think if we look at Bharatiya culture, it will say the human lifespan is 21,600 into 100, maybe, 21,60,000 breaths is an average lifespan. That is how lifespan is measured in. Very interesting, but makes a lot of sense, because that is more like a democratic manner. You know, here it feels, why are some people given less years, more years? No, all are given same number of breaths. How fast you use up your breaths is left to you. The slower you use it up, the more you live. It feels more democratic. So that is what it is. And as you rightly said, the emphasis is not about how many times you take the breath, but on the message that I am divine, that we are reminded of constantly. On that note, dear listeners, we will conclude today's satsang. We will continue with this theme, because a lot more doubts, especially from the Westerners, on different sadhana techniques, including Jyoti meditation. We are not yet done with Jyoti meditation, because some more questions are asked and Swami replies to them beautifully, as he always does. So all of that we will take up in our satsang next week. Till then, Jai Sai Ram. Keep safe. Keep growing closer in our heart. Let us keep growing closer in our heart. Let our love for Swami keep growing every passing moment. We'll now leave you with a song, on the other side of which you will be joined as usual by Brother Chandu in his segment Love to Love. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
ధరి సని సరి సరి ధని సరి గమ గమ మదద మదద మదని సని ప గ మరి మదని సరని రి గమ గమ రి గరి సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సదా మాకు ఇహ పరాలను సగు సాధనం సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సదా మాకు ఇహ పరాలను సగు సాధనం సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం అవప నిరమగమపమ గమద నిరిని దని సరి గమ గరి గరి సానిద ప గమరి గరి ఆలోచనరణి సాయి మయమే అయితే ఆలోచనరణి సాయి మయమే అయితే ఆవేదనలేమి మనకుండవులే ఆలోచనరణి సాయి మయమే అయితే ఆవేదనలేమి మనకుండవులే మనసు తను సర్వం గురుమూర్తేతే మనసు తను సర్వం గురుమూర్తేతే మనసు తను సర్వం గురుమూర్తేతే మహానందమంత మన సంపదనే మనసు తను సర్వం గురుమూర్తే మహానందమంత మన సంపదలే సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సదా మాకు ఇహ పరాలను సగు సాధనం సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సని సరి సరి గరి సరి గమ గమ మదద మదద మదని సని ప గ మరి మదని సరణి రి గమ గమ రి గరి గరి సరి సరి పద పగమరి గమ నిర పగమరి గరి సజీవ కోటి అనంతమీ ప్రపంచ వలయంలో కోటి అనంతమే ప్రపంచ వలయంలో మానవ జన్మం ఎంతో విలువైనదిగా జీవకోటి అనంతమే ప్రపంచ వలయంలో మానవ జన్మం ఎంతో విలువైనదిగా భగవంతుని గ్రహించే జ్ఞానమనే శక్తి భగవంతుని గ్రహించే జ్ఞానమనే శక్తి భగవంతుని గ్రహించే జ్ఞానమనే శక్తి పొందగలుగు జన్మ ఇదే అని చాటిన సాయి భగవంతుని గ్రహించే జ్ఞానమనే శక్తి పొందగలుగు జన్మ ఇదే అని చాటిన సాయి సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సదా మాకు ఇహ పరాలను సగు సాధనం సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం.